Welcome to The Big Table with me, Philip Limbury, and I'm delighted today to have as my guest the editor of the Observer Food Monthly and someone who's been at the forefront of change in British food culture. Welcome, Alan Jenkins. Thank you so much for joining me today.
I'm very happy to do so.
And Alan, tell me about your journey in food, how you've seen food changing, and you know, how has it changed for you in terms of the writing and the editorial?
Well, I think to some extent it changed for me in that I was brought up by an elderly couple that, who didn't kind of trust food in a way. It was like food was fuel. And so food became a way that I defined who I was. I remember I tasted shrimps when I was about seven, and I just knew that they were something to do with who I was. And I think, and I came into food journalism almost by accident. I was working for a magazine, and the Independent wanted me to work on their magazine. And I said, but I have to have a thing, which is my thing. And he said, food and drink, which at that time was still quite new in newspapers. And I think there was an assumption that food was really a female subject. I know when the Observer set up Observer Food Monthly, they set up, first of all, Observer Sports Monthly, which was to bring in men, and then they set up Observer Food Monthly, which was to bring in women. And I'd worked with Simon Hobson, I'd worked with something. I think I came into food journalism at a time when English food started to reappraise what it was. And I think also the world looked at English food in a different way. There were people like Hopkinson, and there was people like Fergus Henderson. And English food had a sort of quite a bad reputation, and it was a time of change and also a time of travel, I believe, and that we started to look at food. And now I think it's changed in that we also look at food in slightly different ways and we feel responsibilities in it, whereas I think at first it was okay just to have recipes and good stories. I mean, narrative. I think food is interesting in that it's still one of the areas that survives in a recession because you can't afford the best car, maybe, or even maybe possibly the best shoes or the best coat. You can, if you're lucky and both of you are working, you could probably afford the best olive oil, or at least a very good olive oil. And I think it's a metaphor for sharing and for nurturing. I'd been a single parent when I was 20, so I cooked always, and it was so it always was part of who I saw that I was, and that thing, because I wasn't, because I was brought up in a sort of slightly strange family, it was important to me that we ate together. I have, my daughter lives, or one of my daughters lives three or four doors from me, and there's a Friday night thing where people come to the house, and we still keep that. So I still like the idea of food as sharing. Food writing and reporting, I think, has become more adult and become a little more. When I took over this magazine, it was very interested in celebrity a bit. There was lots of TV chefs, and I wasn't interested in that at all. And so I guess the pat line, if I had one, when I presented to them and said that I was actually knew quite a lot about food, and you could have, for almost the first time, it would be a man, not a woman, and that, you know, I wanted them to be aware of that. It was obvious, I guess. But also I said it was, you know, you could have less celebrity, more sustainability. So, but also someone with a kind of a knowledge or at least some understanding of some of the impact of food and also how food is implicit in culture. If I live in a part of Camden Town, and if I go into the market near me, you can tell who has been in that area. You can see that there's Bengalis, you can see there were Irish, you can see Poles, you can see Somalis, you can see North Africans. And I think food is just a way that people still hold their culture. We did a piece last month about grandmothers. Mm. And they came from a number of cultures and they hold the food of their grandmother. And that role of the nonna, or the role of, say, there were women who'd come, been expelled from Africa. And that food is still a way that they hold who they are.
Mm-hmm. And to what extent do you feel that the whole conversation about food has broadened beyond culture and beyond, you know, the physical necessity of eating and the hedonism of taste?
Well,
I was thinking more in terms of sustainability,
yes.
the impact of our food. To what extent is that now coming to the fore?
I think it's coming to the fore, but I would question bits of it. I think it's still, to some extent, if I can say this, and this is probably not, I think it's still a preoccupation of the middle classes. I think we've had 10 years of poverty. I don't call it austerity, I call it poverty.
Mm.
And I'm a great believer in trying not to shame anybody who is just putting protein on their table.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, people look at people who buy fast food. I don't, and they say, oh, they should make soup. Making soup takes quite a lot of time. And I'm not about to, I personally will make soup, but that's because I'm a middle class man and I know how to make a soup. And there were times when I was very young with my two kids where we would eat dal for a day or two and then I would add spinach to it. So it was, I think there is that, but I think we're also living in a time of the most mechanized food structure we've ever had. I think we're living at times also of some extremely highly sophisticated, very unhealthy food. We are living in a global food system that I think is problematic. And so, yes, I can walk down the road and I have a decent job. And if I want something, there's a farmer near here who I stay with, a biodynamic farm called Jane Scotter. And yes, I can choose that, but I'm still deeply aware of the lack of choice for a lot of people. And it's that there is an extraordinary amount of choice, but there is no money for it.
Mm.
And I think how that works, and I think there is a sort of mechanism of how that works.
Yes, I think one of the things which always troubles me is that food, the way that we produce food through factory farms, essentially, which is the way that the majority of farm animals are kept, is the biggest cause of animal cruelty on the planet. Mm. And all too often I hear this sort of justification that we need factory farming to produce this cheap meat that we feed to the poor. And my instinctive reaction is that
it's mostly making profit for rich people to sell to poor people, I think.
Well, exactly. And to what extent, can it be acceptable to have a narrative that goes, we need factory farming so that poor people have to feed their children on poor quality factory farmed food, because essentially that's what factory farming does. It delivers poor quality food in terms of higher saturated fats, lower omega-3s and other and health-giving nutrients. And what do you feel in that space is the way forward to ensuring that good food, decent food, and I don't mean just ethical, but quality nutritious food, is something that everyone should expect?
I think everyone should expect it. I think I think even the school systems forgot that that was one of their obligations. I think one of the things that people lambast Jamie Oliver, one of the extraordinary things I thought he did was make people think about what their children are eating. And I think that that was taken away to a large extent. I guess where I stand on it is I come from the underclass, so I still have a sort of sense of the underclass and about shame. And so I don't specify that somebody's chicken should be organic. I specify what we use a term which is the best chicken you can afford. But also I think that people are eating. I grew up at a time when chicken was eaten once a week. And it's now, the idea is it's eaten. It's an everyday food. And how can it possibly be an everyday food? I see that I see that swine flu comes out of a farm that holds 6 million pigs. And it's an American-owned farm in Mexico. That cannot be good. I see animals kept in appalling conditions.
I've been to that farm.
It's not a place of health.
I've been to the farm in Mexico, La Gloria. Yes.
Yeah. But I think that those businesses don't see that as part, and how you regulate those businesses. I don't think we're very good at regulating. I am concerned about Brexit. I'm concerned that we have, for all its faults, some understanding of the kind of foods that what can go into food and how you treat food and how you treat animals. It's a fairly low thing. People sort of applaud the red tractor scheme, but the red tractor scheme, I think less than 1% of farms on the red tractor have an unknown visit. There are no surprise visits. So I don't see then how that can work as a proper...
I think you're absolutely right.
That concerns me.
Yeah.
But what does concern me is the idea that we're actually go back even from where we are now. So, I mean, at the moment, we seem... if I listen to the government, they're saying, oh, well, we'll bring in World Trade Organization, which will allow them to bring in Australian meat. Australian meat has hormones in a way that we don't accept. American meat has the injected use of hormones, the idea of taking in chlorinated chicken. And I worry that farmers I've got a big report in tomorrow's paper, which is the effect of Brexit on food, and it's that farming is quite a long-term planning. So they're committed to a certain thing, and they've already stopped for the last 2 years investing in the way that they would do in things like sustainability, because they have because they might suddenly be competing with a billion really badly farmed chickens. Yeah. And that, and how that works, and how I don't think as a society, and I certainly don't think as a government, I've yet to think of any government that I feel has supported farming in a way, and farming particularly, I think, arable some because there's EU regulations, but I think animal farming is still primitive beyond belief.
Indeed. I was having a conversation along these lines with Chris Packham recently, and he was telling me that he's getting more and more worried about the countryside, about food and about animal farming. And that's making him get up earlier and earlier. He sets his clock to get up, you know, that bit earlier every day so he can cram more in. And I know this is something which is very dear to your heart. In fact, it's the subject of your latest book. Tell us a little bit about that.
My manifesto is that sometimes, it's not for everyone all the time, but sometimes, if you got up an hour earlier, everybody thinks they don't have time. The truth is, time sits waiting patiently for everyone. Birds are awake, everything else is awake, other animals are awake. We are animals, we're creatures of light, and electric light has told us that we're not, and I believe that we are. I have a biodynamic allotment. It's important to me that it's non-invasive. It's important to me that I look after helpless little plants. I only grow from seed. And then I realized after a while that it was because I wanted to look after helpless things. Like as a child, my brother and I were helpless and not looked after. But if I arrive in the morning at that time, I'm treated completely differently by the environment around me. A fox will come onto the path and see me and not be at all concerned. And if I arrived 2 hours later, the fox would run, and it will stop. There was one a week or so ago, and it just stopped and looked at me, and I looked at it, and then it stayed, and then it went to one side and looked through the trees, literally peeked through the trees at me. I will go there, and I will garden, and I will get lost in reverie, and in rapture, almost. And I looked up, and there's a kestrel 6 feet away on my beanpole. That could never happen at any other time of day, because at the other time of day, I'm a predator. The light is sharper, it's clearly defined, and somehow it's almost that they're acceptant of me, I think. But it's also, if I want to write, if you look at the neuroscience of sleep, what sleep does is it detoxifies you. It takes food out and it breaks it down. It takes your thoughts out, it breaks it down. And so you wake up clear. And so if I'm writing, partly to do with time, it's that I can write effortlessly in a way. And it's just, there's a certain magic. I don't put on the light in winter when I come down the stairs. I get up around 4 something in the summer and possibly more, 5 something in the winter. And if I put on light, the room shrinks. A dark room becomes smaller. It's light, but it's smaller. And I don't. I walk down and I'm aware of everything. It's like I'm just, you're aware. You are creatures of light. We understand dark. There is no such thing as dark, in a way. Unless you went into, there's a tank that you could go into. And I make tea, and it's that I make tea by sound, and you know when it's full. You don't need to look at it. You know? And I think that too much time we've taken away some of the magic in our lives, and some of the appreciation of wonder and nature and simplicity. And I think we carry around powerful computers in our pockets, and we yet haven't any idea. And we feel we're connected, and I don't think we are connected. I think that we're disconnected. So for me, I never would have a phone in a bedroom. I get up and I walk down in the dark and I make myself some tea and I'll either sit and write. And that writing will be cleaner and it will flow a little bit more. Later I can still do it, but because I have technique, I'm an experienced journalist, I've been working for a long time, but it will be more crafted and it won't be as pure. And so I think that I just need, and also I work in a newspaper office. You know, it's not a particularly kind time. I search for tendernesses and I search for care, I think, in my life. It's important to me. And at the moment, if you work in a newspaper, the news is not either tender or kind. It's mostly cruel and a sort of celebration of, I don't know, meanness.
Mm. I believe entirely in your manifesto and your philosophy. I'm someone who likes to get up early in the morning. I've been a wildlife enthusiast since I was a small boy, and you're absolutely
right. That's when
right.
They're there.
Exactly. It's so much richer, it's more colourful, and there's more going on.
And you're not a threat.
Exactly.
I mean, I walk out, I have a beach house in Denmark, I'm married to a Dane, and there's hares in the garden. And I can walk out, and a hare will see me, and it'll stop. My ears are alert, and I'll stop. And it will carry on eating. It would never do that. Even half an hour later, when the light's much sharper, it will just see man. And because quite a lot of Danes go out shooting hares, or shooting most everything they can, as far as I can see sometimes, at certain times, they still have hunting as being a manly activity. It's not a... I think manliness is kindness.
I don't think it's
killing so much. For me,
I think you're absolutely right. Sorry. I live on this farm hamlet, and there's 30 of these adorable mallard ducks that come around our houses, and it makes me so sad to think that they're sharing their life, their presence with us, yet they've been released to be shot by the estate next door.
I was somewhere for a funeral, and I saw pheasants. Oh, how wonderful! And then I realised there were so many pheasants that they were actually just bred to die. And it's a different thing. I think that's not magic, that's manipulation. And
Absolutely.
That's not what I'm looking for. I have a field where, I'll go back to the Danish house, and there's a field where the cranes come. And it's as they migrate. And the first day you'll see there's one crane, or two or three cranes. And the next day there's a dozen. And the next day there's... And they know that's where you stop. And they gather, and then they go on. And to be part of that wonder is, for me, what it's for.
Absolutely. And, Alan, really, just to finish off, when you've got up early and you're in this, so much more vibrant yet quiet world, perhaps actually noisier because of all the birdsong, and you're on your allotment connecting with the soil, what is your hope for the future of food?
I hope that people will find a way of being able to be less, less. I would say murderous. I would just say, simply, it's that I think they'll learn to appreciate things a little more. I don't know that it's going to be around the corner at the moment where there's a rise in veganism. But if I look at the math on the new vegans, only 11% identified as doing it for animal welfare. 42% identified it as being for diet or for health. And I think, I guess that means that less animals are being killed, but I think that also if they identify as in that way, they should research it a little more. We will now always, for instance, in any set of recipes, we will make sure there is a vegan and a vegetarian alternative. It's just good manners. Like, we make sure that we have women chefs or... And it's not even that. People say to me, why aren't there all more famous women chefs? So I did the story on the grandmothers. Tomorrow I have a magazine that comes out, and it's women who work in fish factories. That idea that I think elitism is elitism. You don't have to tell food stories of famous chefs. You look at photographs of women who work in fish factories. There's an honest glory to it, a camaraderie. So do I think it'll definitely happen? I would like to think so. I guess where I always am is a concerned observer, a reporter, I think.
Alan Jenkins, thank you so much.
It was a great pleasure to talk to you.